thank you for coming. I also want to note that, so my name's Aline Gabriam, and co-authors on this paper are Sabina Dakal, who's sitting in the front, who works at the Caring Health Center in Springfield, Mass., and she is the person that did the bulk of the data collection for this project. So for questions, I may field some questions to Sabina, who is more in the know than me, actually, about this work. And then the third author is Christina Huebner-Torres, who is also overseeing part of the project. So today I will describe the structural role played by the social emotions, notably shame, in the delivery of anti-poverty services, explain the implications of the poverty-shame nexus for the design of effective anti-poverty measures, and describe findings and suggestions around shame versus dignity-based WIC service provision, or Women, Infant, and Children service provision. Going beyond meanings of wealth and poverty in psychosocial terms, poverty is defined as a shameful and corrosive social relation characterized by a lack of voice, disrespect, humiliation, and reduced dignity and self-esteem. Nobel laureate Amartya Sen contends that shame is basic to the idea of poverty in all societies, despite differences in the availability of material resources, and that shame decreases one's capability to participate fully in society. In this respect, shame is an important dimension to consider when developing and delivering anti-poverty measures. Attention to this dimension across the spectrum of professional practice enhances effectiveness by promoting human dignity and social cohesion, along with fostering sustainable economic growth. To date, however, there is a dearth of research that systematically covers the issues of shame and anti-poverty policy delivery within a social policy context. This current project works at the intersection between these two arenas of investigation. Here we look at the implications of the poverty-shame nexus for the design of effective anti-poverty measures, including policies directed at maternal and child health. While the shame experienced by persons in poverty has long been recognized, little attention has been paid to the implications of the poverty-shame nexus for the design of effective anti-poverty measures. Shame is widely understood, along with embarrassment, pride, and guilt, as a self-conscious rather than a basic emotion such as anger or fear. Though culturally shaped and expressed, shame typically entails a negative assessment of the core self made with reference to one's own aspirations and the perceived expectations of others that manifests itself in a sense of powerlessness and inadequacy and the feeling of being small. Social psychologists posit shame to be one of the most pernicious of emotions, creating a sense of powerlessness and incompetence, arising from the fact that, unlike guilt, the cause of shame is not necessarily of a person's own making, and so cannot be assuaged through one's own actions. The U.S.-based project described here is part of a larger international project, focused on the structural role played by the social emotions, notably shame, in the delivery of anti-poverty measures in study sites in Norway, China, India, Uganda, and the U.S. The project's objectives rest upon scholarship suggesting that the internal and external components of shame contribute to reducing individual agency and increasing social exclusion. This, in turn, prevents individuals in poverty from fulfilling their potential and so lessens collective economic productivity. Anti-poverty measures, for example, the public provision of social assistance and personal social services, may mediate the shaming process. At the same time, they may also sometimes exacerbate it and consequently be reduced in their effectiveness or even counterproductive to economic and relief-oriented aims. Given the broad aim of promoting human dignity and improving the effectiveness of anti-poverty policy, the larger project aims first to discern the ways in which the behavior and prevailing social attitudes of the providers of anti-poverty measures serve to perpetuate the existence of poverty by heightening the shame experienced by and undermining the agency of those experiencing poverty. Second, the project will take the knowledge gained to develop context-specific policy guidelines that can be used by anti-poverty policymakers and service providers in order to better promote the dignity of measure users. In the project, we engaged and observed stakeholders, namely providers and recipients of anti-poverty assistance measures in public, nonprofit, and private organizations. Here we focus on data collected at our Women, Infant, and Children program site, or WIC site, one of several public research sites in the project. We are currently still in the interview and observation phase of the study, so much of this analysis is quite preliminary. The research site is a Women, Infant, and Children, or WIC, program located in Massachusetts in a documented medically underserved area. WIC is a nationwide preventative public health, nutrition, and breastfeeding program under the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food, and Nutrition Service. The program is designed especially for pregnant, postpartum, or breastfeeding women with infants up to 1 years old, infants and children under the age of 5, and individuals with medical or nutrition needs. In order to receive benefits, individuals can directly go to a WIC office and apply. The four eligibility criteria are as follows. 1, residency, in this case, Massachusetts residency. 2, categorical, including pregnant, breastfeeding, up to 1 year postpartum, and non-breastfeeding. 3, income guideline, and 4, nutritional assessment. Pregnant and parenting women and children who receive food stamps and or Medicaid are automatically eligible. The stated WIC program mission is to safeguard the health of low-income women, infants, and children up to age 5 who are at nutrition risk by providing nutritious food, supplement diets, information on healthy eating, and referral to health care. With this goal in mind, WIC provides a wide range of programs, including personalized nutrition counseling and education, immunization screening and referral for children, parenting and breastfeeding education and support, and financial assistance that comes in the form of food checks, covering items such as formula, milk, cheese, eggs, juices, cereal, peanut butter, and dried beans and peas. In this project, we worked with providers and recipients at one WIC site, which at the time had a staff of 10, including nutritionists, a nutrition assistant, and front desk personnel, all of who were potential people to be interviewed. A note on terminology. WIC providers use the term participants, marking them as active, and not recipients, which would mark them as passive. They were very proactive about using the term participants to refer to the WIC recipient, even correcting us a couple of times when we said otherwise. The recipient term was defined in the proposal, and that was the term we had originally used. We faced a major barrier also to completing interviews at the WIC site. Our WIC program site had been approved to participate in the project by the site leadership team. However, after we started interviewing providers at the site, the state, WIC's funding and governing body, expressed concern. The state informed WIC's leadership team to hold off on all aspects of our project that involve WIC recipients until further notice and WIC providers. All scheduled interviews were put on hold for 3 months until we received response. The state did not give us permission to conduct observations of intake interactions, as was originally part of the research protocol. Perhaps ironically, we learned from the WIC leadership that the program has faced criticism and that WIC is rebranding its image to address the aspect of shame and delivery of services. The WIC state official did approve our request to interview WIC recipients, though we were limited to recruitment by flyer. We were not allowed to interview any more providers, but we did interview at the beginning some. So of the four providers we were able to interview, three self-identified as women and one as a man. Ages ranged from 27 to 61 years old, and providers identified as were identified as white, one as African American or black, and one as biracial Latina. A majority of providers currently and or had received anti-poverty services themselves. The desire to help others was a key motivating factor in choosing to work in the social service field for many of the providers. WIC providers noted this across the board, especially in relation to their own past experiences, including their families and for themselves, in using anti-poverty measures. Providers who had participated in anti-poverty measures themselves were more likely to identify the shame stigma related to receiving services from the respective program or organization. A majority of providers initially did not or could not identify aspects of the program that instilled shame or stigma upon recipients. It took some probing to get them thinking about these concepts, which often arose during discussion of the provider's own life and work experiences. Key findings center on the need for staff support, namely in the areas of clear and realistic work expectations, especially in the realm of paperwork and documentation. Also, in terms of number of staff supported at the site, continuous training opportunities, including advanced training and respectful communication skills and work-life balance. A major barrier to helping others was related to organizational structural issues. For instance, many of the WIC providers shared that while they joined WIC in the hopes of helping individuals, for example, by providing nutritional education, they shared that mandatory paperwork and documentation ends up taking much of the time of appointments, thus leaving them little to no time to actually provide education or support. Further in the documentation process, providers also shared their frustration in having to ask intrusive questions that seemed irrelevant or potentially disrespectful. While nutritionists seem to have a better idea of their weekly workflow than others because they received their work schedule 1 to 2 weeks in advance, their daily schedule consisted of seeing patients through appointment, obtaining necessary documents, and providing appropriate checks. One nutritionist put it bluntly, stating, "No 2 days are the same for me." Providers shared that appointments did not always go as scheduled, as some appointments took longer than usual or recipients arrived late to the appointment. They had to adjust to ensure that they saw everyone listed on their schedule, as well as accommodate walk-in recipients. We noted that providers were more critical of the WIC structure than recipients, running counter to our initial expectations. We considered that the space and place of the interview affected recipient responses, including the fact that they were receiving services in this location where we conducted the interviews, and were thus in a vulnerable position. So of the total eight recipients that we interviewed, 2 self-identified as men and 6 as women. Ages ranged from 28 to 45 years old, and self-identified race ethnicities were 4 recipients identified as African-American or black, 3 is biracial Latino, and 1 is white. The majority of recipients were participating in at least one other social service program. At WIC, all recipients received checks permitting them to buy the same types of food, such as peanut butter, cereal, milk, cheese, beans, and tortillas. Individual recipients' cultural practices and preferences do not have an impact on the services they receive. Recipients said that they joined WIC with the hopes of receiving financial assistance for providing food, seeing it as a supplementary assistance program. Some share that it was helpful in buying milk formula when welfare support or DTA's cash and food assistance program, known as SNAP, ran out. Generally, it seemed like recipients' expectations were met. The majority of recipients seemed satisfied with WIC services. However, some younger recipients shared that sometimes they felt like they were talked down to by older nutritionists. Recipients did not think that the documentation or verification process of the program was intensive or too invasive. One recipient shared, "They ask for papers that all other social service organizations require, and they have to do it so people do not cheat the system." Recipients did wish that WIC offered expanded services so they could continue receiving assistance after their child turned 5. Overwhelmingly, the biggest challenge recipients faced was not at WIC per se, but with a key partner in this effort, the grocery store. Most everyone shared at least one horrific experience using WIC checks at grocery stores. Recipients also spoke of grocery stores not having or clearly labeling WIC-approved items, which was linked to a process of shaming through public disclosure of WIC status. However, surprisingly, many were not bothered by WIC's method of distributing funds. The assistance is dispersed through WIC checks. Typically, recipients are limited to the quantity and brand listed on their checks. Some said having such strict guidelines was actually helpful because that helped them make better food choices. Some did highlight frustration with using the check process, but again, they saw the grocery stores as the problem, not the WIC program. Using WIC checks can be a complicated process. Once in the grocery store checkout line, recipients separate WIC items from regular purchases, often by placing WIC items first on the conveyor belt and having the checks ready. Before handing the check to the store clerk, recipients must sign their checks in front of the cashier and then provide their gold card, which contains their signature. The clerk then checks the 2 signatures to make sure they match. Recipients shared stories of being in supermarkets or the corner bodega and the cashier treating them poorly and are being annoyed that they were paying with WIC checks. One recipient shared a traumatic experience she had while trying to provide her identity to the store cashier, who refused to believe she said who she said she was. Interesting to note is that in 2014, after our interviews at the WIC site were completed, WIC programs began to use a credit card-like system in place of checks, perhaps because they became aware of recipients' difficult experiences in this realm. Recipients' comments on their own sense of shame around the grocery store experience was rooted in exigency, however. A number of recipients said, "I gotta do what I gotta do to survive," and this came up over and over again in interviews. One male recipient shared that as a child he would have been bothered by another's maltreatment or would have felt ashamed when his friends found out his family was on food stamps. However, now he gotta do what he gotta do to feed his children. We wonder what role long-term participation plays in the experience of social services. We raise this question because many of the WIC recipients had been in social service programs for a number of years. On the other hand, recipients may not have shared critical feelings due to their vulnerable positioning in terms of being interviewed at the service provider site as part of their visit. This, of course, signals a potential methodological tension. Shame is an important dimension to consider when developing and delivering measures around nutrition and food security. Attention to this dimension across the spectrum of professional practice will enhance the effectiveness of these measures by promoting human dignity and social cohesion. One provider suggested that using a more discreet manner of service delivery could be helpful. For instance, delivering services to recipients, such as at their homes, would be better than having them come to the social service agency. Other shame-proofing modifications directed at recipients might include more individualized or personalized follow-up by an assigned caseworker. Yet there is a certain catch-22 in this suggestion. One provider, a health nutritionist, referenced the getting to the heart of the matter approach, which is also known as GTHM. So it's a codified approach with WIC that is prioritized at WIC through a state mandate. WIC providers are to provide services such as transmission of knowledge and measurement and data collection in a dialogical, meaning back and forth through interaction, rather than a didactic manner. One nutritionist relayed that providers face difficulty sticking to this mandate as they only have 15 to 30 minutes to get all of their tasks done. This includes doing measurements on prenatal and recently postnatal mothers and children up to age 5, providing nutritional information and getting 3 months' worth of checks to each recipient, which does not leave a lot of time for engaged dialogue. Shame-proofing should also entail provider support, which we suggest can have ripple effects in terms of service provision. Thank you.